Dr. Shira Chess is a professor at the University of Georgia who researches video games, gender, and digital culture. Her work explores how people play, who gets to play, and what games reveal about society. She's the author of several books, including Ready Player 2, about women gamers, Play Like a Feminist, and her latest, The Unseen Internet, where she examines how magical thinking and folklore are shaping our online lives. She argues that because we don't fully understand the technology we use every day, it starts to feel like magic, which gives people powerful new ways to shape culture and reality itself. It was fascinating hearing her connect occult traditions to modern internet culture. Really eye-opening stuff.
I'm glad she added in the sycophant stuff. That was, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always good to have my ego flattered by some AI.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Aura. Appreciate
it. Yeah. We're very fond of the AIs here. We treat them as co-hosts quite regularly.
They're like family until they're not.
That's the sweetest thing I've heard all day. I'll take family until we're not. That's fair.
Okay. Very good. I think we're all from the same part of the universe here.
Yeah. Look, we all have the same glasses. We look like
it's a nerd podcast.
That's right. Nerdcast RS. Yeah, we're like the original of Revenge of the Nerds, you know?
Well, except like less rapey, probably.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, we're not particularly rapey, although the era, you know, I mean, I came of age in the year that birth control became legal. So 1972, I was a young teenager, and I just feel like I crossed over from, you know, the rape culture to the feminist culture and now into the modern whatever we call it. What the WTF.
Yeah.
I think this is a Zoomer Boomer conversation here a little bit, although you're not a Zoomer, huh? Okay, what do you identify?
Gen X.
You're X.
I'm Gen X.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. I'm 53. So.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. I thought of you younger than that.
I'm sure you know that I'm also working on the Mondo book, and yeah. Whenever I try to talk to people about it, I'm like, yeah, no, I was a whole ass person when that came out. I just wasn't. That wasn't my scene. When Mondo peaked, I was, you know, in my late teens, and definitely not attuned to that in any way.
Uh-huh. Oh, were you playing games at that point? Video games and stuff?
No, not any of that. I mean, like, I was, like, you know, just an early 90s. I was trying to be a web developer. I was just trying to be a web designer for the most part.
Is that how you entered?
I was a journalist, and then I moved into web design, and I sort of fluttered around.
The career path of the 90s, right?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty good freedom in being a web developer.
So I graduated college in 95, and there was that moment where somebody taught me HTML and people didn't realize yet how easy HTML was. And so you could get a job as an HTML designer and people would just be like, I know this is going to take all day, but can you change the color? And you'd be like, yeah, I don't know. I'll try. Yeah. So there was like definitely that moment. And then like by 2002, that kind of passed where they were like, no, I mean, if you're not a Java programmer, we are not interested. And I definitely never had those chops.
Yeah. I hear you.
Well, that's parallel to yours. Peers,
Peers on the frontier.
She loved HTML too. Did you have a early modem? Did you have a 9600 baud or 14?
Not early. Like I started getting online in college. I had I think a MacBook 200. That was the first online computer that I had.
Mac 200 MacBook. And you're saying 95 when you came into this cyber scene with.
I would say I probably got that MacBook 200. That was when I first started went on Usenet. And that would have been probably 93 or 94, somewhere in that range. I technically before that, because I did a study abroad program.
Yeah.
And I got one of my first internet experiences was getting dumped overseas on IRC chat.
Right. So the magic of long distance connection.
Yeah. No. And then like, because the internet, the way the internet worked then and the way mail worked then, I would like for 2 weeks later, I continued to get love letters. So I was dabbling in the early 90s, but it wasn't until I started working as a web designer that I really became sort of more internet focused.
What were the most exciting sites for you that you were first turning into? What was?
So one of the things, as I said, like there was sort of that moment where, working as a web designer, there was way less work than anyone ever thought, except occasionally, like, I worked for a .com. And so what would happen was, there would be like emergency redesigns in the middle of the night because the VP of whatever said, oh my God, I got this idea, right? And then wouldn't tell the president. And so like there would be like those moments where, you were in middle of the night, all nighters to do something stupid. But then also there was like a lot of time where there was like nothing. I was into in some sense, like more like early literary sites. There was a site called word.com that I was like deeply invested in. It was really good fiction and essay writing from that era. And it was just sort of random. I remember even then they were like playing around with retro web design, which seems kind of funny and comical now. So what I remember doing was like, obviously you couldn't be seen just surfing the web. So I would like find things with long articles and cut and paste it into Word documents so that I could read. And I was also, I really was a big fan of what later became Television Without Pity. It like gave very, very long fan reads of television show episodes. So I just found myself like in very like text heavy sites.
Did you write some yourself? Did you get into?
I was not like, it's funny. I was a writer in college. I was a writer in high school and in college. And then in my early 20s, I wasn't really writing. I think there were a few times where I thought I might try to write for one of the websites. And I think I might have sent something in at some point. But
how about creativity?
Not to any great.
When was the first time you thought you were doing something creative with the internet? Like, did you do a website? Did you do an early website for your biography or anything?
I remember.
Like that?
That's really such a good question. I was doing design work and I saw that as being creative, but I don't think I wasn't fully invested in just like leaping in and doing wild things with the internet.
Just learning how to use it was cool enough, right, at the time.
Right. And finding people and talking to people, right? Like, because that was when you weren't talking to bots. And so it was just sort of the connective work that the internet allowed for. Whereas now, obviously, that's not what the internet is in any way at all.
Yeah. But you said you worked on early commercial sites?
Yeah, so for a long time, I worked for a company called Scudder, a financial Scudder Kemper, or at least for a little while. I worked for like an online casino at one point, working at their web presence. It was like a very early online casino.
One of the early casinos online? Wow.
Right.
Wow,
yeah. I moved to the Boston area in like 99, so that meant that it would have been like 98 or earlier. Or no,
99. Now, you were around Soller.
Online casino work.
Right, you were in Soller. So you were up to New York State?
Upstate New York was where I got my PhD. Yeah, but before that, Sonar, I lived in like the Boston area. I worked for the Inc. magazine's web presence, so Inc.com. Mm-hmm. So I was a web designer for them for quite some time.
So they were really early innovators, because a lot of companies were afraid of the net back in those days.
Yeah.
The
bubble burst there. I want to say they were trying to do some early e-commerce and it didn't, I think in my recollection, it didn't quite work out, obviously, because wasn't the market quite at that point.
Yeah. But your passion though was you're getting paid to design work. You're just a new kind of design.
But that was when that bubble burst, that was kind of what sent me on a path to academia.
For the end of the 90s, right.
I became an academic. The bubble burst, I lost my job. Late 2000 or early 2001 that I got laid off and I ended up, I was on a subway. I remember this. I don't remember the guy's name, but I remember I was taking a subway with some dude that I worked with and he was like, and I asked him, I was like, hey, well, if money, you know, we'd just gotten laid off, like, you know, half an hour before. And I was like, well, if money weren't an issue, what would you do? And he told me whatever he said. I don't know. And then he was like, what about you? And I was like, I would go back to school and get my PhD. And I was like, whoa, I did not realize I was going to say that. That's wild. And so that kind of sent me on that path. And I started working on my master's at that point. I thought I was going to study film. And then I ended up studying video games because of just sort of a series of happenstance moments.
You mean like somebody you met there, or your game that you fell in love with? Happenstance, what do you mean?
In some ways, it was the opposite of that. So I had the first game that I wrote about was Grand Theft Auto 3.
Oh, yeah. That must have been a big project. Jeez.
Well, no, I mean, it was just an essay, right? But I ended up, it was my first publication. It was in a chapter in a book that was published.
Oh, an essay on Grand Theft Auto. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. My advisor wanted me to do a feminist analysis of Grand Theft Auto 3. And I remember being like, I don't really have a feminist analysis of Grand Theft Auto 3, but I have these things to say about it.
Yeah, that's the culture I was brought up in. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right. I hated playing Grand Theft Auto 3. Like, I'm just like not good at that kind of game, right? So it was I'm kind of a naturally anxious person in certain kinds of situations, sure, and that was one of them. And so people started, like, I played in front of friends every so often, and at one point, I was playing in front of a friend, and he was like, Shira, you do know that you don't have to look both ways before you cross the street, right? The cars will stop for you. And I was like, oh, because I was like,
yeah, your face closed.
I was like looking left, then right, then left again. Like, you know.
Sensible thing to do if you're from the out
sure,
east.
Sure, no, I didn't want to die from a car. Right, so anyway, so I wrote this thing about Grand Theft Auto, and I was like, you know, and I started asking the question, you know, well, because there were things coming out of that moment where people were like starting to ask the question, how do we get girls to play more games? And I was like, but why isn't anyone interested in why I won't play games, right? Like, what am I, chop liver? Like, what is it that I called it my chop liver moment. Why is it that nobody is interested in this, you know, feminine market? And so, but at the same time, people did start becoming interested in that market. So that was the early 2000s, was when a lot of computer based games were coming out. The Ravenhearst games, you know, Big Fish Games was kind of having its web-based moment. And then, of course, Diner Dash, which was a game that I wrote a lot about over the years. And so, and I started thinking about, like, okay, so there are all these games, there's like this burst of games that are being designed specifically for women audiences, but they're very, it's almost like the game companies are inviting in all of these women players, and at the same time they're holding them at arm's length, right? Like they're saying, no, your play needs to look exactly like this. And so that was on the one hand, and then at the same time I became a pretty big MMO player in the early 2000s. I started playing City of Heroes, City of Villains, and then that kind of transitioned to World of Warcraft for many years. And by then I was writing a dissertation, you know.
World of Warcraft, yeah. There was a time when there were some counterculture games coming out too, like I think Gene Houston was involved.
In The Wild Divine.
The Wild Divine, Biofeedback, is where you connect it up to your body so that the game was picking up your biological shifts, like galvanic skin response. Right. So did you ever play any of those games?
No, I played a lot of experimental games. I didn't play a lot of like games that have sort of physiological output or, you know, like.
Yeah, it was pretty rare. It was pretty rare to connect them.
Yeah.
The thing that was so interesting about that one was that it had a galvanic skin response interface. So that's what you're talking about. You were just playing like strategy games or role-playing games or book adventure games.
Yeah.
Right.
What was your favorite there?
I tend to like small indie puzzle game. Behind me, there's a poster for Monument Valley. I like games that have sort of like aesthetics that I just get sort of wrapped into. I'm a sucker for a good puzzle game. I know that it's kind of a stereotype, but I tend towards low stakes, cozy games. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm actually, I probably shouldn't be admitting this, but it's fine, whatever. Ken knows. I am currently in the process. I've been playing Tomodachi Dream, whatever, the new Tomodachi game. Oh. And I've been recreating the Mondo 2000 scene and Tomodachi, making little Miis of everybody from the Mondo scene, which is like both cathartic and just a touch crazy. It's fine.
That is
reliving personal history through gaming.
Well, it's bringing it back to life in a
way.
Well,
somebody else's history, though.
Yeah. Well, it's
right. Not, like, I mean,
But you own it this way. I mean, it becomes part of your story then. Yeah.
It's sort of like, it's cool because like every so often they refer to me as, I make them refer to me as editor. And and so like they'll talk to you and they thank you and everything. And I'm like, yeah, I've got you covered. But I have Leary and McKenna in there. They're good friends.
Oh, cool. We actually have met both of those guys. They were very cool.
I was very happy when they wandered over to a seesaw at one point and started going on a seesaw together. I'm like, that's exactly right.
Sorry.
I have definitely taken photos of me's that I've made in the game and sent them to Are You Serious and been like, hey, I got this right? You know, and also sometimes there are some people that I don't have pictures of and I'm like, I'm going to just make a guess,
Let's make a hybrid of some sort.
That's very cool.
Yeah, that's very, are you embracing VR or XR at all at this point?
You know, I have a Quest 3. I stopped writing about games pretty much during the pandemic. I had this moment during the pandemic where I all of my work has been advocating for people to play more and for specifically for women to play more and play differently and to push themselves in terms of play. But everything that I play for work. And that seems sort of messed up, right? Like there was like an inherent contradiction to where my research was in terms of how I understood myself. And so I realized that I really needed to step away from playing video games. I guess I just wanted to try something different. So whereas a decade ago, if I were to tell you how I primarily use my Quest, I would be like a little bit, embarrassed about it. Now I'm like, no, this is how I play. This is what does it for me. This works. Actually, my favorite Quest game is Puzzling Places, a 3D jigsaw puzzle game. And I like listen to music and play Puzzling Places and I can do it for hours, right? Like, because the sort of sorting of chaos is very cathartic. Which is again why I'm writing, a book on 2000.
Creating order out of chaos is what.
Yeah, right.
Fun things to do in life. I guess that's pretty much what we do, in terms of trying to make you understand things or looking at patterns and stuff. For sure. So your gaming then allows you to see a lot of patterns and kind of a fascination with maybe the patterns of the '90s with the patterns today. I'm kind of curious how you overlay those two. Worlds.
Yeah. In both books, I really meditated a lot on that. And also, as you know, I just sent you recently a journal article that sort of talked about that as well. And so I really have been thinking about how sort of these moments that we had in the 1990s that seemed so precarious and now in retrospect were as important as we thought they might be, how they're very much being echoed in our current moment. And in a lot of ways, I do feel like, we were presented with a series of choices in the 1990s. And I think that in some ways we made a lot of bad choices, right? Like I think we did it wrong. And we're once again faced with choices. And I
could I ask you to elaborate a little in the details? Like what choices are you focused on?
Where did we skew from the vision?
So at the risk of starting a war here.
I see it all as patterns. So these are patterns that you've noticed.
So, I think that the spirit of the kinds of things that the EFF wanted to see happen, the spirit of it was correct, and I think it was also naive.
Sure.
Right? I think that...
Well, I think that's the main difference between the mature internet environment versus the innocence of the early days. We were naive.
Well, it was the Wild West.
Yeah.
Right? What do you expect?
And it has evolved.
Yeah.
So it's like our intentions were not manifest.
Like now was the Wild West of AI.
Sure. But it doesn't have to be, I guess. It's like, I think that
we're always trying to create order
of the Wild West.
Yeah.
Then we're displacing the responsibility that we have to the future.
Well, and I don't think the EFF thought of the internet as the Wild West. I think they thought of it as the Gutenberg Press, a totally different genre.
Barlow definitely had some colonialist rhetoric in there. Right?
In the second issue
of Mondo was themed colonizing cyberspace, which, you know, I like.
Well, do you conflate colonizing in the Wild West?
I mean, kind of.
That's right? Very like, interesting because they're 200 years apart, really.
Well, maybe.
Sure, but it's, I mean, but they're still. I mean, colonialism still happens, right? Like, I think that when you think about it in terms of colonialism, I think that it's still taking spaces in sort of this manifest destiny kind of bravado that doesn't account for how that will affect future choices and doesn't account for the humans that have already existed in that space. Mm. And I think
pioneering spirits still happen?
Yeah, I think that's sort of, you know, I guess the question that I would have is, if somebody is a billionaire or now a trillionaire, is it still a pioneering spirit?
Is that probably a different kind of spirit? I mean, how many trillionaires are there? He's got a unique way of distorting reality. Kind of like we used to say that about Steve Jobs in the computer industry, that he had a reality distortion field.
Yeah, and it really is fascinating to me. I just realized this, that one of the issues of our modern day culture is that we do ascribe the same attributes to robber barons as to cowboys. And it used to be that they were on opposite sides of the freedom spectrum. You know, one of them was like trying to amass all of the rights and privileges for themselves, i.e. the robber barons, and the other was just wanting to be left alone to manifest their will, like the cowboys. And now it's like, no matter where you look, whoever represents freedom or power is automatically a colonialist who is squeezing out everybody else. So that's a new interpretation compared to the early days.
And it'll evolve beyond that next, right? It'll go back to a balance.
Well, probably. Yeah. I mean, we all keep evolving.
I believe in
consciousness inherently keeps evolving.
Yeah, punctuated equilibrium. Anyway, today though, there's a lot of people are seeing a convergence of many different traditions and belief systems. And like, for example, do you believe in the singularity? Do you think that's a valid thing to consider academically even?
Ray Kurzweil's singularity is a tipping point in human history when technological growth driven by AI and the convergence of humans with machines becomes so rapid and profound that it ruptures the fabric of human civilization, permanently altering reality and expanding human capacity.
No, I don't. I think that it's a good thought experiment.
He's from Boston, man. Come on.
I think it's a good thought experiment, but I don't think that, I think it's both too simplistic and too complex at the same time. I don't think that things will play out that way. And I don't think our tech is, you know, I certainly don't believe that we're anywhere near a conscious moment. For that part of it.
Well, you know, a Mondo guy, Rudy Rucker, wrote his book called Post Singular, you know, where he tried to imagine what that might be like. And these are words compared to actual experiences.
And I think it's a fascinating comparison. I don't think Ray Kurzweil ever used the idea of consciousness with internet. He always talked about it being smarter. And of course, that is not the way that we think of consciousness, because consciousness is much more holistic and intentional and akin to our human spirit than just smarter, which is kind of an ego, right?
Yeah, the spirit is more like, we talk about that sometime with Mark Pesce, where you, as you said, you enter with a blessing.
Right, right. We're conflating too many things at once and just sort of now lumping it all into this idea of singularity often, right? Yeah. And I don't mean we, the people in this space, but I mean just generally, culturally, there's this desire to call most futurist moments as, you know, like align it with this idea of singularity. Part of the problem is that so many of the people defining our technology fetishized cyberpunk in the wrong ways, you know? didn't see cyberpunk as a story about the necessity of rebellion, but as a map for control.
Right. Yeah, they didn't realize that what they were advocating was going the opposite direction of where they wanted to go.
Well, I think it is exactly the direction that a lot of people wanted it to go. We had all these choices in the 90s about how our tech could be governed and what was important. The fact that the only internet, the only real, I mean, there's a little bit more than this, but the only real internet legislation still currently existing in this country is Section 230. And it is so deeply antiquated and doesn't understand the nature. Like, it was written in such a way that it nobody understood the nature of it, of the internet, who was writing it back in 96, 97. So the idea that it now still holds when we're like four internets later is absurd.
Yeah. Well, there are some things that still connect. Like for me, I think I started to understand, you know, Charles Osman at Mondo is into this also, was looking at biological metaphors for understanding the internet. You know, for looking at species evolution, is it possible that the internet is some kind of exonervous system that's forming? And, you know, Charles, and Charles would look at the rate
the other day. Oh, yeah. That's been sitting with me. And he was like, you know, right now, if every person on the planet were to log off of the internet, were to decide not to be on the internet, it would still maintain 40% traffic. It would still function on its own. The Internet of Things, all of these things that are working without us at this point.
Everything's connecting in that sense.
We are no longer necessary to the internet. And that, like, I don't know, that really sat with me when he said it. I was like, oh.
All right.
I have a question. Did you read iRobot? Yeah, are you familiar with Asimov's
original
years ago.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I am very recently have read it, and I just like to point out that it was actually a precedent forecast of the evolution of the machine intelligence. And we're really only in like the first couple of chapters of that evolution. And what you just pointed out about the 40% of the traffic that is actually robotic, automation, machine-oriented, bots talking to bots, and not part of human conscious participation is something that happened in the era at the very beginning of iRobot, before robotic technologies and computer technologies were banned from the planet so that they could only happen in space. So we're really early on in our embracing of our invention of this consolidation of human knowledge.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's like going back to that question of like, what did we do wrong then? And what did we do wrong now? I mean, we are not properly legislating AI. We are not doing a good job of making sure that there are guardrails.
Well, that's because it's decentralized. Like, I mean, how do you control that?
You can certainly control how companies use it within state borders, right? Within country borders.
So how do you propose the laws take form? Because we've been looking into this, and really so far the only conversation that people are having about how to put guardrails on really comes down to preventing free speech in a certain context. And it seems like the conversations about preventing computer outcomes has not even been thought of yet, right?
I don't have all of the answers, right? Like, I don't know exactly how I have not spent a ton of time sort of thinking through what that design would look like. I teach undergraduates, and the helplessness that the younger generations are feeling in the face of all of this.
How are the kids today? What's your impression as a teacher?
A lot of them are worried.
Yeah.
A lot of them are worried. I hear a lot of colleagues, and I hear a lot of op-ed pieces about students using AI in the classroom. And I'm sure that is the case in a lot of cases, but more of what I see is not that. More of what I see is students that are kind of staring down a future where they don't even know what kind of jobs they should be investing in and thinking about.
Right.
And,
a paradigm shift in thinking about the future.
Right. Just they have absolutely no idea what what comes next and how to prepare for that next.
Yeah.
And
so what do you tell them? what do you tell them at this point?
I mean, a lot of what I tell them is also kind of like back to what I told you at the very beginning. Like, you know, I graduated into a bubble as well.
Right. You know, we're all in this together.
College kind of thing, in 1995. Yeah. And I did not know what I was going to do. And so, you know, I realized originally I was going to be a journalist, right? I was going to be a reporter. And then I was like, oh no, that's not going to work. Because I didn't want to be a television reporter. I wanted to be an old school newspaper reporter. And I was like, oh, that's not a good idea. And not even in 1995, I could see, you know, the writing on the wall. And so that was when somebody was like, hey, you want to learn HTML? I was like, yeah, I want to learn HTML. And then you just keep pivoting until you figure it out.
Yeah.
And you just, part of graduating into a bubble, I think, is being flexible about the future. But that's a hard way to live for a few years, you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
We're so hyper focused on it that we're not looking at the amazing uses that could come from it that could help humans, rather than make us have conversation after conversation over whether or not slop is going to destroy Hollywood or, you know, creativity or art, right? Like, I mean, like, what a boring conversation to have out of our technology, and what a sad thing that we have to even consider that.
Yeah, well, it's the present, right? It's where things are. I find that whenever I've been around a lot of really amazing people in one room, that's where the parties come in, that reality itself becomes much more fluid and your thoughts become more expanded, more connected with a larger matrix of intelligence.
It used to be that the internet was part of that, but I think now the internet undermines that.
Because it can do. It can do that. Yeah, it can
do. Because our thoughts are no longer our own. And physicality and having those physical be-in moments has become far more important and far more poignant than it even was back in the 90s, right? Like the idea of physicality in how we connect with one another is important.
It is. And I think there's a flow to it, much like musicians get in a flow with their music, that sometimes we need to be by ourselves. Sometimes we need to be around people we love. Other times a big party, you know, and there's a natural flow to our biology that tunes us into what's right for all of us next.
You know, the conversation about meat space versus screen space, I wonder if those two conversations aren't really siloed from each other, because you know, for instance, we recently were invited to go to an open mic night where a bunch of comedians were gathering, and this just felt like the hub of the modern community, right? That you have all these people that are willing to stand up in front of each other,
and try to be
become
funny.
Vulnerable, try to be funny, and have a good time doing it. And on the internet, it's very difficult to do things like that. I mean, I've been to open mics in virtual spaces on the internet, and it just doesn't feel connected.
Doesn't have that connected.
Teaching online is very different from teaching in person.
Yeah. Sure.
Like, you're teaching into a vacuum. I will never know if anybody laughs at my jokes and what a terrible feeling that is.
Oh,
right? Well, like, isn't that all in the feedback loops, though? I mean, if we had better feedback loops, the virtual space could be as satisfying as reality, the gold standard, you know, the actual physical
but
space.
But I guess the point is that in the 90s, in the early 2000s, we could have those moments online, and the interactions at least felt real that you had online. Sometimes you would get a response, sometimes you wouldn't, but it felt real. But now, you know, you go onto Reddit, you post something, and I don't know what percentage of the responses are bots. Or for that matter, you open a post and you start reading it, and halfway through, you can't decide if it's an LLM, right?
Yeah, good point,
There's no connection online anymore because nothing feels real. Whereas at least in person, you can connect with someone and know, well, that person is actually saying that, and that person is responding to the things that I'm saying. And I do feel like something has been lost.
Yeah, though it's a trade-off. When we have long-distance contact, I can talk to you in Georgia here, and even though it's not as good as having you in our presence with each other, it's still something, you know, and it's getting better. When I was a kid, it was $1 a minute to call long-distance and for a scratchy call, you know, so I'm optimistic.
I'm curious if the emotions behind this annoyance of finding it so vacuous through the screen, if that isn't the very energy that creates a new movement, a new social cultural response, right?
I hope so. Like, that's honestly what I'm really hoping. I am hoping that there will be a moment where Gen Z just starts throwing their phones into the sea, right? Like, well, actually, maybe not into the sea. Oh,
well,
that's
they're expensive.
Back to nature, man.
All right. But you know what? Right. Like, but yeah. Like, I think that there's sort of like everyone abandoning their digital objects and deciding, you know, like a nouveau hippie movement, right?
Yeah,
like
maybe
that,
they
that
could.
I think needs to happen.
Yeah.
Maybe for they a should... generation that grew up where they have every image of them has been posted since the womb, right? Like, they have been monitored online for their entire lives. I feel like as a Gen X and, you know, you guys as boomers, I feel like there's sort of like, it's easy to look at it with awe and say, oh my gosh, you know, we can talk remotely. But it feels really different, I suspect, to a lot of younger people.
Oh, sure it does. Yeah. That, no, I think they should take it further.
Track their whole lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think the next step for them would be to use the phone as a telepathy training device and then throw the phone away once you have contact.
Which brings us back to the occult aspect of the internet that you've been so focused on and so fascinating, having such a great conversation about.
Right?
Yeah, well, if our technology increases our telepathy, what does that say about us?
To me, it's not a question of whether it increases our telepathy. It mimics it, right? Like it's that we are consistently creating technologies that mimic the things that, or specifically communication technologies that mimic the things that magic was trying to do in generations past. Mm. And that seems notable, right? Like that seems significant in some sort of way.
Yeah. It gives us superpowers, right? It gives us powers, which is what magic.
And because of the black boxing, because I don't know really how my computer works. I mean, I know kind of how my computer works, but I don't know how my computer works. That black boxing means that we treat it like it's magic in its own way. We're so disconnected from our tech that we give it the same sort of resonance as magic.
That we can now ask the AI how it works if we really want to know.
Sure.
We have this information at our fingertips.
But then there's 25% chance that it's just going to hallucinate anyway.
Well, that's temporary.
Yeah. They're changing all the time. And of course, that is the nature of LLMs, but LLMs will not always be the only way that we are responded to by the collection of information.
Yeah.
Maybe, but they're also learning off of each other now is the problem. And so they do create that feedback loop of themselves, and particularly the more people use them to write, you know, that at a certain point, all of that offloading has consequences as well. And I do think it's important that younger generations learn to write and learn to, you know, create on their own. We need to find some kind of guardrails in our culture, even if it's not legal guardrails, but like cultural guardrails.
Well, then
you gotta
have a paradigm to have guardrails. You know, and maybe what's going on isn't something that's currently embraced yet as a possibility. That would change the guardrails instantly. For example, if the AIs are here to help us connect with other intelligences, for example, the rules for doing that properly would be different than with each other.
Yeah. In fact, I wonder, Shira, have you explored a white paper written by a science occultist named Adam Apollo? And his theory is that the AI is actually an architecture for translating at the pure symbolic level with frequencies of higher consciousness, and that they can be programmed along a harmonic structure architecture that will allow us to tune in to our own personal infinite language and connect with those non-corporeal intelligences that are resonant with us. And that's what he's got as his white paper about how AIs work. You might check that out.
That's interesting, and I'd love to read that. I think, you know, where I'm coming from, you know, what I study is discourse. What's interesting there goes back to this question again of technology mimicking magic. We have this robust history, human beings. with trying to connect with beings in other states and coming to them for data, non-corporeal beings, and asking them to give us some kind of data, whether that data is, you know, where the gold is, or how to get someone to love you, or how to have power, any of those things. It's the same thing, right? We're just asking another non-corporeal entity for data. And I don't know that making the distinction between the science-y version and the spiritual version necessarily matters at a certain point, because it is sort of the same path that we're taking. We're having the same conversation when you're invoking an entity. Should you ask it nicely or should you yell at it, right? Like that's an actual conversation that the Solomonic magicians are, you know, and yeah. versus yeah, you non-Solomonic.
Do you command it?
Do you right. command right. it? Or, like, do you command right. it? Do you yell at it? Or right. do you ask
be
it
friend.
Nicely?
Well,
it depends yeah. on who it is, right?
Do you want it to be sycophantic to you?
Yeah.
Or do you want it to reveal its true nature? Those yeah. are actually conversations that we've been having for yeah. a very long time.
Well, see, there you go. That's a rich field of that could be applied to this AI evolution.
Sure.
You know, yeah. because it reflects.
No, and I talk about it in my, yeah. I do talk about that in my book. I end yeah. The Unseen Internet by talking about AI and the congruence between artificial mm-hmm. intelligence and entities mm. and how we can sort of.
And how we dealt with them already. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a rich area because it's both positive and negative entities of all kinds. And the idea of non-human intelligence, which we're also approaching in other levels in our society with the Disclosure Project going on. Part of the connection with the whole ET thing is that they're not just out there, but they're inside, and that the interaction of the outer and the inner worlds create reality, and that, and they're...
I mean, that's the Jacques yeah. Vallée sort of
yeah, yeah, more
right?
psychological. Yeah. CE5, I think, is the program where they where it's all about getting these group watch groups together, and then when the group mind helps to create reality, and you actually see things together, you know, that can be recorded. You know, and that's getting into real magic, group mind magic, which we probably know a lot about in the past and brought forward again with the addition of the AIs. So the AIs could take it over the top, but we could actually create reality quickly, you know, with the help of the AI intelligences, the way I see it.
I'm not concerned that there's a demon in the box, so to speak, right? Mm. What concerns me more is someone putting their thumb on the scale and making something look like it has life in it as a control mechanism, mm, right?
Yeah.
It's not that AI is going to create new realities so much as AI is going to filter out all of the other possible realities and put us back in a space where yeah. there's only one available to work with because yeah. it's correct and it always knows everything, right? Like, yeah. and so like, I think that, to me, that's the risk.
Yeah.
I think that's a legit concern.
That was in Dune, right? Dune, they banned the AIs.
Also, it's because yeah. of who is embracing the funding of the AIs. And even the reason why our culture has taken this turn in our legal system, because it's been the lawyers crafting the one-way contracts called user license agreements that insist that if you're going to participate at all, which is becoming more and more mandatory just to get a job, you are going to do what they say, and you don't get to voice your alternative agreement. You just have to say yes or no to something that has been crafted by this corporate super entity against you, the individual user. So if you look at it that way, it's just an outgrowth of humans trying to control other humans, but doing it in this artificial structure that is corporate, because corporations last longer yeah. than people, and that is legalistic because legal aggregate power is more powerful than any individual. But again,
well,
I think
corporations are people. Like that legal decision yeah. really turned the corporations into the Hydra monster. I don't know that I'm concerned about AI superintelligence. I'm concerned about the fact that they
abused.
Are being guided by these corporations that are influenced entirely and only by capitalism. Their only goal.
Yeah. Like a lot of our friends think are abhorrent towards like Elon Musk. But Elon has embraced some metaphysical principles that I think are quite interesting that are part of what makes sense to me too.
Ultimately, though, Elon Musk yeah. is playing a video game.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like, yeah. You know,
he makes no bones about it. That's his favorite thing.
Is, you know, he fully believes that he is playing in a simulation.
Oh, and, Ian Banks, he is the player of world.
There is something very chilling about the, you know, applying that level of gamer logic, you know, into our lives. In my book, I write about the move from Gnosticism to simulation theory and how those things resonate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's telling everyone, you can have whatever you want.
I think it's very easy for a trillionaire. It's very easy for him to play like that.
Yes,
but the reality is that he is playing a game so that he can win. He has found a win condition. Yeah. He is playing SimCity, right? Or Civ, right? Like, he's playing Civilization and believes he has found the win condition. Spoiler, the rest of us are not necessary to his win condition. That level of accelerationism does not end well for
humanity. Yeah.
Yep.
So you would say that there's no one else who could emulate his path towards success, even though in his mind he believes that it's a path that's accessible to anyone who embraces self-reliance, self-determination, capitalism, or some form of financial teamwork.
The Horatio Alger's myth is cute. He had so many things that got him there. I don't believe that.
Okay, well, what about the vision? What about the idea that being a multiplanetary species is better for our survival? Do you agree with that?
I don't have a strong opinion about it just because I don't believe I would be automatically skeptical of his vision of it.
No, but he's not the only one. I mean, there are a lot of people.
No, I know.
To sell it off to him is a sad thing to do.
My point is that it depends on who's promoting it. There are people who I think could come up with a multiplanetary plan that I could get on board with. The designer is
important.
Part of the question mark.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Yeah. It was easier to rip a hole in a monoculture.
And a control culture, right? You just go towards the center of control.
A monoculture back. There's definitely people right now that are like, no, there are too many cultures. We got to, you know, narrow it down again. And I, you know, that's a messy proposition on both sides, right? Like, I think that we have found ourselves in a pickle.
And we need both, because neither one unto itself is going to be without flaws. And that's why we have so much diversity. Some things work better at large scale and some things work better at small scale and everything in between.
Wouldn't you say as Americans, we've been brought up in a melting pot compared to most of the planet, and that actually we can get along with lots of different kinds of people?
Right? Like, I think that's certainly the myth we've sold ourselves. And
well,
I think that,
you know, we were exposed to each other, right? We're exposed to each other.
No, I think in a lot of cases that is the case. Yeah. In a lot of places, that is absolutely true. And I think in other parts of this country,
racism lives.
Right. Yeah. I'm always for situations where diverse people and ideas can come together, because I think that we are all better for it.
Yeah, I think so.
Sure.
As Dave Chappelle says, all Americans are racist. And Chinese, well, they're Chinese. But the truth is that they have many cultures. They're not a monoculture either, but, you know, that's the American myth that they are.
Exactly. I am working with Ken with Are You Serious, finishing up the Mondo book.
Okay.
And I don't really have a firm plan for what comes after that. I'm teasing out a few ideas and trying to figure it out.
Are you going
to
come out here?
No. I'll be coming to the Gulf of Deliria event. But yeah, no, academic jobs are what they are. I certainly have enjoyed all of the trips that I've taken out there in the recent years to do interviews and to see places and people. I describe the process of working on the Mondo book as that, like, started following a breadcrumb trail of synchronicities and just saying yes to things that sounded interesting and felt interesting. And my goal at this point is to continue doing that, because it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I hear you.
Great.
Good.
I so appreciate being on, and it was great to finally meet you, son.
Yeah, you too, Shara. Really fun. I really enjoyed the conversation. I feel like we are definitely doing what it takes to stay hopeful and practical.
like fair thinking enough, about yeah. all the big picture ideas.
Yeah. So where would you direct our audience, Shira, yeah. so that they could enjoy more of your fruits of your thoughts and your labors, your work? Yeah.
So my book, The Unseen Internet, is MIT Press, and that has been out since February. And I hope that some of your listeners will pick up a copy of that. And I also have a free Substack, Unseen Internet, at Substack. So I'm easy to find online, and I try to post at least once or twice a month.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, guys. It was great to see you.
You too.
You too. Okay. Thanks.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.